Whatever that is, I'll leave it to you, Stuart. Thank you for coming to Many Rivers, folks. We appreciate you. And we appreciate Kenan being here to tell us about his modern take on the relevance of Hermetic tradition in our very exciting lives these days. And as you probably know, Kenan is a person who has made a big shift in his own life from software engineering to something more mystical, if you will. So I'm very interested to hear what he has to tell us about his involvement with the Hermetic tradition and what he can pass on to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. And thank you, everybody, for coming. It's, part of the reason I study what I've been studying and doing what I do is, I think partly is because I get to share it with all of you. Otherwise, what would be the point? So, some of Carl has actually been helping me to craft. Maybe I should say that at the end. But thank you so much for all your support. So I've been fascinated with some ideas which tie into the Hermetic tradition. And so for today's event, which I hope will be interactive and casual, because we're not a lot of people here. If you had seen the flyer, it was about one of the anchor points was the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below, as within, so without. And it comes from the Emerald Tablet and by the famed prophet, if I may, Hermes Trismegistus. So that's sort of an anchor point, and what I find very interesting with it, it came to me that for this event I had to find an anchor point, and so that's the anchor point. And it's an anchor point, I feel, for many, many spiritual traditions and maybe even technological, scientific traditions, which at some point in the past, during the time of Hermes and the Hermetic tradition, which comes after him, were quite connected. So going to this... Let me see. Technology, all of that. Okay, yeah, so... What makes this sort of Hermetic? And welcome. We're just beginning.
Fantastic.
So the Hermetic maxim, if you had seen it on the flyer, is sort of the anchor point for today's event. And so as above, so below, as within, so without, comes from Hermes Trismegistus. And what kind of makes it Hermetic? And I use this image to kind of go into the etymology, the origin of the word Hermetic. And so it begins with this figure in history, Hermes in Greece, and then Hermes is also identified with Thoth in Egypt, and later on with the biblical prophet Enoch. And so this identification of three different people in history with Hermes itself indicates something about the Hermetic tradition, right? That it's, in one way, it's living, and it's sort of an archetype that reveals to us the transcendent dimension of the macrocosm with the lives that we live here. And it does it in different cultures, in different times, so it's sort of beyond space and time. And it's a living tradition, meaning that when we contemplate today's maxim, as above, so below, it is alive within each of us. It gives us diamonds and jewels or understandings that are not orthodox. They're not fixed in somebody said something and it never changes. So it has this shape-shifting ability. And another word that is very interesting to me around what makes it Hermetic is polymathy. The ability to understand and connect multiple areas of study, be it mathematics, geometry, sacred geometry, spirituality. And that is what Hermetic is in its essence. Another very interesting phrase is hermetically sealed, right? So what that means is that the text in this case the Emerald Tablet or the Maxim, will reveal the understanding to where the individual is at in their evolution as well. Also perhaps their culture, the language they speak, and the time and space, meaning the culture that they are born in. So that is kind of the wide understanding I have of Hermes and Hermetic, and hopefully we can use it in our collective imagination, hopefully, and contemplation today. So if we have a, as above, when we say as above and so below, maybe I check with the audience, what does it indicate to you? It could be, if it brings any image.
Well, certainly astrology.
Right.
It's a mirror image and of what's synchronistically happening in this present moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mirror.
Yeah, thank you. I like also how you brought in synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you had astrology, one of the words that comes to me is geography with it. It's kind of lay of the land or the lay of the universe. So I like this phrase from one of my friends, John Hughes. You guys might know him. He is a tantric scholar, disciple of Swami Lakshmanji, one of the famed master. And he coined this term geography of consciousness. So I just changed it hermetically a little bit, geography of spirit. And so that we're going to go into it. If you're interested in cosmology, the cosmos, then maybe geography is an interesting word to sort of use as a way to understand it. We do have geography. So what is that, by the way, that music? Is that a phone?
Is that my phone?
Oh, it could be.
I thought it might have been me for a second, but it's not.
Not me.
It has a purpose.
I just thought that was the music in this room.
Yeah, no. I was like, am I supposed to?
I guess when you're in the room, that is the music.
Yes. Okay. That actually is something very interesting. That is a big part of its vibration and sound. So, sacred geography. What makes geography sacred versus non-sacred? And I was thinking about that. So, in our contemporary world, one could think of Google Maps or maps. I mean, I sometimes find I'm addicted to them. It takes me places. And every year, perhaps now even faster, we have more and more information in it. You know, the latitude, the longitude, the wind, where the cops are at. Mm-hmm. And now we have cars that drive us. So one day we might actually be driving in the map, not looking at the map. That's a possibility. And we might actually be quite close to it. I'm not saying it's a good one. So that's something to actually think about. And then what makes geography sacred? Okay. So this is an image. That's the most classical image I could find. This is the image of a myth in the land of India, wider India, which post-colonialism has many countries now. So in this myth, we have Shiva and Parvati, the goddess who creates the world, also known as Sati. And the brief version of the myth is that she's at a ceremony with all the deities and gods, and her husband, Shiva, is not there. And they're saying bad things about Shiva. They're even trying to put black magic on him and stuff. And the myth is kind of longer as to why that's happening. But she feels really insulted, and she's not given the respect to herself and to her husband, so she decides to commit suicide. So she kills herself. So when Shiva returns, it was unknown when he would return. When he does come, he's furious. So he takes her corpse and does the dance of destruction. Mm-hmm. So he wants to destroy the entire of creation, mm-hmm. which is well within his means. So then another god known as Vishnu wants to pacify him because they don't want him to destroy creation, including all the gods. So he throws at him one of his weapons at the corpse called the Sudarshan Chakra, which is kind of like a ninja's star. Mm-hmm. And so the corpse gets dismembered. That's dismembered. And perhaps that's what we'll be doing today, and we do in our human life, is to remember the corpse. So the corpse becomes dismembered and falls at different places on the planet Earth. And that becomes then the map of India. So this is the I didn't want to confuse you with all the names. Don't try to read it unless you have great vision or remote vision. The map is essentially this is a pre-colonial map. It doesn't, it's not a longitude, latitude, GPS coordinate, but it is all the sites where the body of the goddess has fallen. These are called Shakti Pithas, literally translated would mean stargates or power spots. So people in India at the time, there weren't countries perhaps, but what there was that these kind of people go to pilgrimage here. Those kind of people go to the pilgrimage at another site. And this is kind of a general overview of what sacred geography is. And of course, it's replicated in places like Greece and many other parts of the world. And then later, post-colonization, there has been, first part of the colonization attempt was to, I don't know if it was a conscious attempt, but the pilgrimages were removed. That knowledge was lost. And then more recently, in the last 5 or 6 decades, there has been an attempt to combine the kinds of map, our Google Maps, with the living animistic map of where the power spots are, where people perform pilgrimages and connect with the land. And this is one of the photos where the idea is that it's the feet of the pilgrims that map the landscape. This is the famous river Ganges with the spirit of Mother Ganga. You probably all have heard of it. This is another figure for a similar kind of idea called the Kumanokoto in Japan, which is a famous ancient pilgrimage that has been revitalized and died and revitalized again and again. It belongs to the Shinto tradition, which is a very animistic tradition in Japan. It is very, what I love about it, I recently read a book called Kumanokoto, Pilgrimage to Power Spots. I highly recommend this book. And this pilgrimage is really a nature pilgrimage. I mean, every pilgrimage is, but this just, nature is just profound in this one. And then I just wanted to quickly share images just to spark our imagination. Of course, we have Egypt. This is where we just don't only have nature as what is sacred, but combination of human imagination and technology. In a way, technology in its ancient alchemical sense. The era of Hermeticism, when technology and inner processes of contemplation and spirituality were the same thing. That's where alchemy and the word chemistry later on comes from. This is sort of a site in India, and this is a consecrated device, so to speak, that houses a certain kind of energy body or body of consciousness. There are many kind of replicas of this across India and are called lingas, which have the different chakras, if you know the subtle body, and map the male and female energies. And people can have different kinds of experiences when they enter these spaces. So this is sort of part one, I would say, of the talk. And I enter into a little bit of a contemplation here. If you are going to enter into a sacred geography versus our geography, where we might be using Google Maps, what would be the difference? And perhaps one difference would be to be a pilgrim versus a tourist. And I like to reflect with you, maybe what is a pilgrim to you, or what might be a tourist to you, or if you spark a difference. And you just have some reflection.
Well, pilgrim has a higher purpose. I'm trying to connect with something, or I'm going to a space because of a need or a yearning to connect with something higher. As a tourist, I'm usually going to more for entertainment, or to check off my bucket list, or to post something on Facebook, or all the wonderful things we do these days.
Yeah. Yes. Lovely. Thank you. Yes, Carl?
I would suggest this capitalizes a little bit on what Stuart just said, but the pilgrim brings vulnerability to the trip, being subject to learning and to being changed by the experience.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Not learning, just learning about, but some inhabiting the learning.
Thank you.
Maybe an underlying theme of devotion towards, like, an open curiosity and connection.
Thank you.
I like that, the idea of humility in the pilgrim, whereas the tourist sort of has a kind of a hubris.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm thinking that the vulnerability of the pilgrim relates to as above, so below also. Because it's like humble, but you could experience being connected to something above.
Yeah.
And then I was making this joke in my head of the tourist, it's like as below, so below. But anyway.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I think that encapsulates it very well. The pilgrim, I feel like, in my words, it kind of pays to experience pain in some ways, whereas the tourist is paying to avoid pain, right? And devotion and vulnerability. In pilgrimages in India or in the Kumano Kodo, it's a big desire traditionally is for people to connect with, in Japan, with the kami, the gods or the goddesses, and the same in you want to have an encounter with the goddess, and pain is part of that. In extreme cases in Tibet, which I don't know how they do it, they do these long pilgrimages with continuous prostrations. But also to say that tourism and pilgrimage does have an overlap, and I think it's often mixed. We have to sort of decide. I know of a friend who, in part of his ritual, was to write a will before he left for pilgrimage, which in ancient times was the case. Often, if you went to the Himalayas from the south of India, it was a one-way ticket. I mean, most of the time you probably would not make it because the journey is long and other things, illnesses, wars, whatever.
I had something that came up about pain, like that the pilgrim would have a goal of maybe using pain instead of it just being this crappy thing.
Oh, yes.
So it can be a useful tool.
Right.
Instead of just something to avoid at whatever cost.
Yes. And that also reminds me that we forget to emphasize ecstatic ecstasy and rapture, which is part of the pilgrimage. It does happen. And partly the pilgrimage often is designed to really dismantle the mental cobwebs and something else to emerge. So people, you know, and pilgrims experience a lot of joy when they meet other pilgrims on the road. Okay, this was a question that I already sort of kind of posed. And that's a deep one. Maybe it's going to be a continued contemplation. Can the map replace the territory? And in the current sort of technological era, I think oftentimes we go in that direction, maybe unknowingly. We can have virtual reality and simulations. And would any of you like that or not like that? Is there a strong provocation one way or the other?
I feel strongly both ways. I feel that starting from a map, one can create a territory. But if one wishes to understand what the territory is, one needs inevitably to discard the preconceptions about what it is, which means getting rid of the map in order to fully experience what's there.
Right. Yeah. Somewhere I read that sometimes pilgrims don't have a destination. That would be an intense pilgrimage. At least for me, I'm not very spontaneous, but that would really scare me. Wonderful. Yeah, that we can take this contemplation. I think it's becoming very relevant in our times. I've been trying to make a point of going back to the old maps when I drive around. Because with the nav that I have in my car, I have this tendency of I don't need to, it just tells me. I have to find a Starbucks. Starbucks on the way, and it just tells me, or you know, grocery on the way, and it just pops. It has to be organic. It knows all these things, and totally, essentially, takes me into a mental, more and more mental realm. Mm-hmm. So I was like, how do I break that? And interestingly, one of the reasons we want to have a map, be it a hermetic text, a spiritual text, which is, you know, the spiritual geography of consciousness, of spirit, is to orient ourselves, right? We're in this journey of life. What's our orientation? And meaning making, the map helps us to make meaning. And if what is interesting is this is a deeper theme, so I just put it here. As the body of the goddess falls, it connects, it gives us these anchor points to connect with transcendent truth while in this perhaps microcosm. And I find that in our era, more and more, we have symbols and images that are not really related to anything transcendent. McDonald's. Maybe it points to immense amount of suffering, but it's not really grounded in any transcendent truth. And if you have a lot of symbols in society, a lot of pictures that actually point to nothing, then what is our compass? What are we orienting to? It kind of becomes random.
Yeah, another gloss on the map versus the territory that comes up for me is sheet music.
Which music?
Sheet music. Like I can have a sheet music in front of me, and that's like a map. Mm-hmm. But it's the sheet music is nothing in comparison to the performance. And even as a performer, there's a degree to which, if one's reading the music, the mind isn't sort of mediating the performance. Whereas if you're really well practiced and bringing life to the music, something living and something transcendent actually can emerge. But it's still the same notes on the sheet of paper, so it's a map.
Yes.
But the map is a guide or a reference or a way of reconstructing a full experience, but it's not the full experience.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that's what's getting really interesting now, to your point, technologically, is at what point does the map become the territory, and there's this collapse where, you know, a robot generating music is doing that predictively based on a huge index of essentially map, but the experience is very difficult to decipher in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, and it's going to be one that we get to, whether we like it or not, have to explore soon, because yeah. Is there a difference? I know when I use the music example because I study Shakuhachi with a master teacher, and what he's trying to elicit is truly something transcendental. I mean, it's like energy, non-physical energy or feeling, the conveyance of feeling, artistry, elegance, point, something higher. And no matter how good AI is, I can't see it recapitulating that in its current form. I can see it can be technical, but I know there are lots of technical players of the Shakuhachi that I see who are masters of technique, and yet they can't embody that quality that even a very simple tune can demonstrate. You know, it's a different kind of mastery.
Yeah.
So I've been fascinated by maps all my life, and the initial experience that I had when I was 5 years old was going to a huge, it was in a neighbor's yard actually, in a huge sandbox, and I spent hours creatively generating a territory, a three-dimensional territory that I imagined as a map, but that has the, in other words, I guess I'm trying to point to the fact that maps we generally think of as two-dimensional and territories necessarily as three-dimensional. But when I was 5 years old, when I was creatively unconstrained, I didn't understand how that worked. And I'm wondering if maps have to be two-dimensional to be useful, and if territories have to be three-dimensional to be useful. Mm-hmm. So your prompt earlier, the story about the pieces of Parvati falling to earth all over the place, both creates a two-dimensional map that you demonstrated for us, but also a three-dimensional territory. So it's, these things are, they're good to think about.
Yeah, yeah. What that brings to me is a very important thing. You know, where what's the role of imagination in all of this? Mm-hmm. Because if you take sacred sites, for instance, part of it is it's historically sacred. Something has fallen there, or something is there. Mm-hmm. And part of some of the images that I was showing, for example, where something is created, it could be created by an individual, a clan. It could be because many people for thousands of years have been going to pilgrimage there, and that adds a different kind of, well,
morphic
also
resonance.
Adds energy. Sorry?
It's morphic resonance, what Rupert Sheldrake talks
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe you're alluding to that, and I see that in my two-year-old nephew a lot. I probably make a few reference to him. I'm sort of learning. I think part of if you can return to that childlike innocence and imagination, that's a powerful upgrade in spiritual. I think I'm trying to like deconstruct the mind so that imagination is available.
I think about when you say, can a map replace? When I think of map, I think of the frontal cortex, the idea of thinking as a realm of its own. Mm-hmm. And that so much we are caught in this way, there's constantly people. I'm a psychotherapist and have a certain client who's on a real spiritual path, but he just loves to talk and ponder all the various things, and that's so different
yeah.
from direct experience. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So the idea that so often the maps are obstacles to the direct experience.
Yeah.
And that maps require a reader. They're really
yeah,
nothing without somebody to interpret
mm-hmm.
it
mm-hmm.
or put it to use.
Mm. Yeah.
I was thinking the same thing when you were talking about the child. It's
yeah.
the map has this quality of, like you said, orienting or meaning making
mm.
or, it's the mental layer and the territory is necessarily emergent, and the child, even if they're in the sandbox, realizes that
I was excited.
Yeah.
I was excited to be
yeah.
to have the power to blend these two things.
Create
yeah.
a
yes.
world. Yeah.
And why you still do that in the garden.
That's true.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I think part of in my own journey, I've wanted to resurrect that joy and excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, children have it very naturally. And just a comment on maps. Interestingly, some of the ideas that I'm discussing in the little bit of time we have are very dense maps, actually. Mm. But they're spiritual maps. And I feel like they are the kind of maps that they can give, ultimately are supposed to give an experience.
Mm-hmm.
They can actually develop the subtle body and the mind into a cosmic mind. You're chewing on a cosmic idea,
mm-hmm.
a cosmic thought that bears fruit if you wrestle with it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the thought that is and the wrestling with the thought that is actually creating the subtle body, or is the map in a sense like a frame? And through the energy of imagination, we start to add juice or energy to that frame, and we're building something based off of a pattern. But it's a imaginal act. It's returning to the map. It's not a cognitive thinking or figuring something out.
Yes,
it's It's more like coming back, in a sense, like being a pilgrim.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I like how you intuited that. I put the pilgrim there as an attitude. And oftentimes these maps come with deep exercises on the subtle body. A lot of the practice, these sort of texts are practice manuals, essentially. Not just an idea, but trying to enact that in ways with the subtle body or with the mind. Okay, so we return here. This is sort of map one. There's just an idea on this microcosm, macrocosm, or so as above, so below. There are many ways to perhaps think about it, and I'm just distilling a few of them, and I'm realizing that we're enjoying this interaction, and probably won't be time to cover all the maps, which are not all the maps. Reality, by definition, is radically infinite and incomprehensible. So this is not to get anywhere, it is just to perhaps joy, and there's another thing that I'll share at the end. What could be the purpose of creating such maps or becoming a pilgrim? So this map points to something very interesting, which is fractality. That the same structure that is above can occur below, and above and below here are just placeholders, right? I don't know what above or below really means, as we might discover later. But I think most of us are aware of a fractal. If you look at this image, and if you keep zooming at it ad infinitum, although this looks very elaborate, one discovers that the same structure is repeating itself. And in this case, since reality is radically infinite, one doesn't know where the structure begins or ends. So this is, I say radical infinity because this is the kind of infinity which has infinities nested in it. What more could be said? The more I say, I confuse myself. So I go back to this myth to elaborate on this idea of fractality and something, the technological aspect, something that I want to share with you. In the title of the talk, I said, "You are the Stargate." And to communicate that idea, this sort of map is relevant. So in this story, I mentioned that the body of the goddess falls all over India. And what this body of the goddess is, you might have heard this many times, another spiritual maxim, everything is energy, everything is vibration, right? And as being in the sciences, I've tried to always, prove myself or think through, as you're mentioning the models, is light a vibration, is sound a vibration? You know, am I a vibration? And even scientifically, every solid, even a stone, is vibrating and is 99.999% space. I only know it because that's what the quantum physicists say. The body of the goddess falls, but what this is the a vibration. These are different vibrations. And I put this quote here from the biblical quote, in the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So this points to in the biblical concept of logos. And as the body of the goddess falls, this is the Sanskrit alphabet. This is what falls. And that is the Hebrew alphabet. And there are other alphabets that have the similar quality, that each alphabet, the vowels and the consonants, are sort of these higher vibrations condensed into form. So I don't want anybody to get a headache, but this image, don't worry about reading it, but this is from, we're looking at the idea of a fractal, and this is from a text called The Inner Pilgrimage of the Tantras. So what this is that all the initial map that I showed you of India, where the body of the goddess had fallen, has now been transposed onto the human body. So here the human body has become literally a fractal or microcosm of the landscape of India or even the universe. And many, many tantric practices are based on that. So you can perform the pilgrimage if a practitioner has evolved to a certain point that maybe requires innocence or purification of some kind, imagination. They can perform the pilgrimage either simultaneously while being on a physical pilgrimage or just internalizing the pilgrimage. And this might be a familiar image. You perform yoga, and oftentimes there are mantras that are placed on the body. Mantras are just a combination of the glyphs the characters of the alphabet, and not just in yoga, but also in the Sufi traditions, the Kabbalistic traditions, and the Greek traditions, Hermetic traditions. So this is just the vowels across the spine. And so what I'm trying to show is that when these alphabets are combined, be it in Tibetan or Sanskrit, you form what is called the mantra. And this is a concept that I became enamored with, that the mantra, in this case it's the mantra of the deity Vajrasattva, and it is the address of the deity. The point of reciting the mantra, the sonic code, would be to have an encounter with the deity. You could call it the address of the deity, but more in terms of the yogic terms, this is a technological term, address. Each one of us has a phone or a computer, and the reason we can communicate because we have addresses, what they call IP, internet addresses. But the mantra is actually an embodiment, which means that the sonic vibration results in the body of the deity. And I was told to share stories, so in my practitioner experience, the deity for the practitioner can emerge from within the body, and have an encounter, which is very mysterious. But when we have this idea that we are a fractal of the macrocosm, it's not that mysterious. It's still mysterious. It always remains mysterious, of course, the encounter, because you don't know what the encounter will be in one way, or what will happen as a result of the encounter. But the practitioner, of course, longs for that encounter. And it can also result in the destruction of the constructs that you have to the birth of something new. So it's kind of like this, the point, the invisible point, the horizon that you aim for to know what's next. And maybe technologically we are in an era, once again, interesting times, where something, we can sense that there is something that's coming forth, and perhaps we're asked to place our trust in that. But anyways, yes, this is the basis of deity practice. Deities are also, in a way, constructed by practitioners of very high imagination, perhaps. They're also cataloged. It's very interesting that we also live in an era where we are having UFO disclosures now in the West, which doesn't have traditionally sort of ontology or cartography of beings in other dimensions or worlds. So I feel like the paradigm is kind of shifting. Yeah, I just wanted to share this image, which is a concept image. Something that I'm very interested in is that we have this astral travel or an encounter with the deity, and when it happens, it feels more real three-dimensionally than here. And I don't want to go too much into this, or not at all, but you can ask me. This is something I'm very passionate. Possibility of having a technology that allows one to pass through a doorway to go into a different dimension or a planet. And this has happened before, particularly in Hermetic traditions, and the schematics are available, and perhaps this is, we are in an era that invites a confluence of technologies in the past and the present.
So is that a paint? I mean, that's not a photograph? That's an image that's constructed?
That's an AI-generated
right.
image through
yeah.
a concept
yeah.
that I presented.
Oh.
So I notice at the very bottom there on the left, it looks like this figure is supposed to have walked on a platform and then stepped off the platform into the sand. Am I imagining that, or is that...
You could be, because the... one of the challenges with AI-generated imagery is that it's never perfect.
It
leaves much to your imagination or disdain.
Yeah, she probably has six fingers on each hand.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It is getting better, though.
I don't know if that's the good news or the bad news.
Cool.
I think it's good for those of us like myself who are not trained as artists, so I get really excited.
Yeah.
But those of my friends who are artists... have different feelings. Okay, so we're kind of running out of time in the sense that we did want to do an exercise, but Actually, this is some quick maps. We just expound on what we've already discussed and probably most of us know. So the maps that we shared earlier, we can zoom out of these maps so the territory can become larger. And in many of the traditions, the different planetary bodies, you were mentioning astrology, this is in yoga, particularly in the Sufi traditions, I've found that the different centers in the body correspond to different planets. So, you know, it's a human body is considered like the product of a potter's wheel, and the potter's wheel in this case is the solar system and the bigger cosmos. So, again, this idea of the fractal and geography means that in concept, in our imagination, anything that is out there is within our reach. In terms of remote viewing, which is becoming popular as a technology these days. The concept of angels in the biblical traditions corresponds to the sphere of the sun and the other bodies. And they don't call them aliens, but, you know, for example, Saturn, the beings of Saturn, the Sufis often speak of them as soothsayers, oracular, about the future. And, so another interesting map or perspective, which is sort of present in science in the form of quantum mechanics, where it talks about entanglement, where everything is interconnected, right? Einstein called it spooky action at a distance, because he didn't know why that happened. How could something light years away impact a particle that was here? So if you take that as truth or the traditions, you might have heard of this image called Indra's net. And this comes from the Buddhist tradition where the whole cosmos creation is full of these jewels that are interconnected. And the quality of each jewel is that it simultaneously reflects all the other jewels. So that's just mind-boggling if one thinks of it. And I had this experience once on a psychedelic. And it was ayahuasca many years ago. And what I experienced was that I was a star and that I was looking at other stars. But the problem was that whatever star I looked at, I was simultaneously looking back from that place as if I was there. And I mean, I never assumed that I would find an image for it, that I was the chosen one. But I did find an image, which was Alex Gray. And when I saw that, I was like, this guy knows what I experienced. Mm. So this is an image by Alex Gray, who's a visionary artist called The Net of Being. And so, you know, maybe there are beings like that. If you look at the text, beings who are have a cosmic view of the cosmos. And many deities that we, as practitioners, connect with have that kind of a view, give us some reprieve from the difficulties of human life. Okay, and maybe the sort of the last image in this piece that I want to show is, does anyone know what this is?
Bruce Lee?
Bruce Lee.
Yes, thank you. Makes me happy. this is actually from Enter the Dragon. But this is not actually Bruce Lee, this is a newer movie. I haven't seen it, but I thought this picture was, again, this idea of entanglement and reflection. And what this is showing is the hall of mirrors. The Sufis often use this phrase, that reality is like a hall of mirrors. And what I like about this image is that one is spooked by one's own perspectives from different points of view and has trouble navigating. But that's just one interpretation. You might have a different one. So there are all these sort of levels of entanglement and fractality and reflection, which I contemplated because it gives tremendous joy and can also generate an experience of something like that. And I was maybe going to do a small exercise here. And the exercise is that if you feel invited, you could close your eyes and we could contemplate or imagine this sort of interconnected and mutual interdependence, mutual reflection. And and as we open our eyes in a couple of seconds, you know, we look into each other's eyes and we reflect. I mean, so if you open our eyes and we can look at our neighbors, at each other, and this is essentially the cosmic reflection within our means, reframed. And and this could be an ongoing exercise. I wish I walked in the street like that. We reflect consciously or unconsciously, because I feel our personalities evolve and are fixed at times because of the reflections that we offer each other. So, And maybe the last one that I will share, and then we can either discuss or do another contemplation, is this perspective of involution. We, in the scientific paradigm, always hear about evolution, you know, from monkeys to chimps to humans, from amoeba to us, which is great. But what about involution? So involution is how did we get here in the first place? Right, and often that's the domain of spirituality, and the map that I am showing here is, does anybody know what map this is?
Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah, bingo.
Blake.
Yeah, William Blake, Jacob's Ladder. And so, in this map, you have man at the bottom. You're moving through, at least in the Hebrew and the Sufi traditions, they're called the jinns. Each one of us is a jinn, has descended into the earthly realms. And as you move further to the source, the sun, like could be literally the sun in our solar system, you have the angelic sphere. So each one of us is an angel. And the sun would be the source, or the truth, reality, the macrocosm, transcendent. And what is interesting is we could take this image to be in time, right? It's happened historically. We came into here. We have lost the memory, and we need to remember, put it together. From Parvati's body of the goddess that was dismembered, we can remember, put it together. And also, memory and imagination could be equivalent, right? So we can remember in the past, or we could imagine now. And another interesting thing is that the angel and the jinn can also be considered oversouls or personas, higher personas that are here with us right now, that kind of know the trajectory of our soul, right? And it can be invited. We can seek guidance from that aspect of ourselves that has perhaps lived many, many lives, and perhaps will live many lives, will have more journeys. And it's sometimes interesting to come in contact with that perspective from the perspective of the pilgrim from down below. And another kind of fractal aspect of the same map, which is used very extensively in the Tibetan traditions, is waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, which we experience every day in the cycle. You know, the astrologers know, in this cosmos we're in a cycle. It's the same cycle. It's not disconnected cycle. So we go through these three states, and the deep sleep would be the equivalent of the angelic sphere, the dream would be the jinnic sphere, and the waking would be the human sphere. And the fractal doesn't stop there, as to when we go to bed and have a dream and have a deep sleep, many of us actually daydream. So it's nested. Each state can be nested in the other state. And many practices are built to bring this into the awareness of the practitioners. And I have promised that what is the point I don't know if I promised that, but I did mention that I will share what I think is the point of the journey. So maybe I share that and we close with that, and we could either do an exercise or we could just talk for a bit. And I shared this Sufi quote. It's actually from the Prophet in the Islamic tradition. And he says, in response to why creation is there in the first place, and the response from God is, or truth, or the goddesses, I was a hidden treasure and I wanted to be known, so I created the world. So all these maps that we have seen, in my own journey, I find that at some point I became enamored with the idea of transcending from the pain of being human. Right, and that often is represented by the idea of Maya, illusion. The world is an illusion. Then I find myself transitioning to the concepts in Indian traditions called Leela, which is play. It's a divine play, so be playful. And now I find myself at what I feel that this saying is, this maxim is sharing, which is, and also connecting with the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below, is that our job is to reveal what's hidden, is to reveal the transcendent here, because what is hidden can only be revealed on this side of the Mobius strip, or the hand. It's the same thing. So I find that empowering, because it makes me engaged in the world, doesn't want me to go anywhere, and also gives me the feeling that I'm a creative collaborator in a divine longing, which is a mysterious longing, because it doesn't come from a place of lack, but it wants to reveal the unmanifest into the manifest. So I maybe stop here and check with you if you have any feelings about any of this. And otherwise, we did have a little practice. I don't know if we're out of time for a short practice. But we'd either discuss or do practice or do both. And that's it.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
So what is the practice?
Oh! So the practice was, which is interesting, thank you for asking that. The practice will begin here if you so choose to do it. You don't have to do it. But it continues and it goes with you. And the practice was that people were invited, everybody was invited to bring an artifact, an object. No problem. If you didn't bring it, it's not a problem. It could be any artifact that is meaningful to you or invokes something in you. And there are some there on the table, and actually many of us folks, thanks to them, have given permission to use one of the artifacts here. If it's small, maybe you could take it in the hand. Otherwise, you could even connect visually from here. I have a couple of artifacts there. I have my sword and staff. This is from the Aikido tradition. And I have a stone there. And there are many deities here as well. That's Shiva, there's Ganesh, and they're all over the store. So we could connect with those. And the point, really, the exercise is that after all these sort of maps that we've talked about, and hopefully marinated it a little bit, tiny bit, just to put the caveat, I was speaking with Carl, that this is not to simplify the maps. This could be lifetimes of work, and we're just beginning, and so we can make a first contact, so to speak, with the deity or an object, with full curiosity, with the possibility that it's a microcosm in itself. It's a symbol of the macrocosm, meaning that it can catapult us into a deep connection with what seems far. Often that's my case. It could be that some of us have a lot of nearness with stones or with different deities. And maybe I share a quick story and just to maybe put us in space. So that particular stone, I'm not a stone person.
Which stone? The pink?
That stone, the orange stone on the table. Mm-hmm. I 5 or 6 years ago, I was not into stones, but I was becoming a little curious. And so I wanted to get a stone. So what I did was I went with a friend of mine, and she's super into stones. Mm. Right? She's a Reiki practitioner. She uses stones there, and Nadja is her name, and a very Egyptian kind of spirit. So I went with her, and she guided me, and I did my best, as skeptical as I was, to be open to her guidance. And so I picked that stone from a shop. And if I remember correctly, started sleeping with the stone and didn't do any elaborate processes, but I was with the intention of knowing something. I don't know what that was. So anyways, I did have a dream, a very powerful dream that felt extremely real, one of those dreams where you actually question if the dream is more real or where you woke up is more real. Anyways, I met three beings who were in tuxedos, right? And they performed a healing on me. They're like, we got a health canon. And so I was totally game on, and my persona in that dream was fully game on with these doctors, I may call them, in tuxedos. But it was very apparent to me in the dream that they were beings of the stone, right? And there was kind of an orange aura to them and the space. But I wasn't really observing too much because I was receiving a healing. So that kind of shook me from a skeptic to that could happen. And like any spiritual experience, the experience has a stamp of its own, meaning that it speaks of its reality and truth. And I've always found very difficult to, I can't even remember any time that I questioned any vision of mine, because it comes with that self-evident reality and truth. So yeah, we could do that.
Let's do that. Let's offer the opportunity for anyone who did not bring something with you to perhaps take one of the animal spirit guides or one of the colored stones there. That's easy to have space for something and to borrow it. Mm. Of course, if you want to take it home, you must
take
buy
it.
But for the evening, you can borrow it and put it on the table, and we'll find out what we do with it as you lead us.
Yes.
On. So
yes.
I'm going to take my little flashlight and put it here.
Cool.
And invite you to come forward and do
the
same.
Where are the stones you mentioned?
Over there.
The stones are out by the window.
There's puffy heart stones under a paper that's over there on the white counter. Okay. And there's worry stones and serenity stones. It was interesting to hear you tell the story about that stone. Because I basically picked the Manogion. I have trouble saying Manogion. Maven Ogion, because I had the dream where I was Maven, and then later I found out who Maven was, and that he was doing the stuff I was doing in the dream, so. Yeah.
Ah, wow.
That's cool.
I'll go for you. You read the instructions closely after that. You're the greeting guy, yeah?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to that rapid response thing they said.
Yeah,
are you
okay.
Going to be
I'll
there
see
too?
You there. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you get the information yet? I guess they're sending out tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, great. I like it. That's our altar.
Oh, we're supposed to put it on there?
We can, yeah.
Or you could
keep it too.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So essentially, there isn't really a lot of guidance. Each one of us, I think, is fully capable of making an encounter, and some of the ideas that we've been hearing of our imagination, really permission, curiosity to make first contact. Maybe you've already connected with this deity or ruby, star, stone, whatever it is. And really the kind of consciousness that we want to bring forth here, I feel, is dreamlike, you know. Can we dream right now, or allow our experience right now to be like a dream, to be open to that possibility? We're not going to find out it's a dream until we wake up, anyways. So, yeah, making contact, you could allow your senses, as your, even if your eyes are closed, your senses to go around this object, right? You're exploring behind it, above it, inside it. You know, maybe asking the question, what is it? What is the idea of the goddess that has manifested here in that form? We could be curious about that idea. Idea in the mind of God that has revealed here. And be curious to know its depth. Also, feel free to welcome any kinesthetic interaction with this object, however it may appear, as a mode of engagement. Possibility of a more intimate encounter is also available, you know. What would it feel like to be or become this artifact? Feel it in our body, what it is to be this vibration of the artifact. We can welcome sensations that want to show themselves. They could be images that appear in your mind. Or thoughts. Really, we're desiring curiously to have an interaction and you know, we can also connect with our intent. Why was I drawn to this artifact? Just that very pure curiosity doesn't need to have an answer, but that energy of wanting to make contact. And if thoughts of doubt or skepticism emerge, that's actually very welcome. We could also invite a presence into the artifact. What kind of presence, what kind of a being or energy would you invite into the artifact? You invite this presence, it becomes an act of consecration. One can also contemplate what the object, when you touch this object, or you with your sense perception, with your thoughts, your imagination, how does that transform you? How does this object, this artifact, touch you back? Our desire to make this connection can also be in the form of a prayer. Feeling the support of our collective gathering here, of our collective intent to perform this experiment. As we slowly start returning from this contact, can we be open to gratitude for making this meeting, making this first contact with an alien being, different than perhaps ourselves? Just like ourselves, a different idea in the cosmic mind that has expressed itself. intention that this contact might support us in our lives as a friend, perhaps as a guide, as a protector. Land in this room. Come in contact with the chair. Bringing all five gross sense organs back into the body. How was it?
Nice.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. I think are we out of time? Yeah. But if anybody wanted to do a quick share, I think it can be mutually informative to, but it could also be very something that's private. We are here in a dream. And I find that the nighttime, this is, we're already in the evening, yeah. post dinner, mm-hmm. And you're going to be entering into the dream realm, so it would be great to actually somehow maintain whatever contact there was, or just even the intent, and keep a journal next to your pillow. Never know.
I'm just recalling that I had a dream this morning, and just as it was fading, I was going, oh, I was with three healers, and I was trying to recall it as it was dissipating, but now I recognize, because I kept feeling into it is a really good space.
Mm. Wow.
Oh, that's a synchronicity.
Yeah. I want to meet those guys again.
Mm. Yeah, and it's, I think it's a good symbol of this whole exploration tonight, in a way, right? The time, it's like the timeline, it's really shifting. It's like it's collapsing in a way into the moment as we move into the future.
Yes.
And heal or resolve the past.
Thank you.
I'm curious about you have been in software, and what are you doing now that's working with this? I hadn't gotten the back.
What I do now?
Yeah.
I do a podcast, and I'm hoping to, this is what I'm doing now.
Uh-huh.
I'm interested in studying stargates.
Uh-huh.
And making them and trying to figure out how to do that. And part of the sharing this is to find collaboration and
So the AI image you had, that was a good sort of a symbol of the Stargate idea?
Yeah, the idea is quite ancient. So there are many images actually and such places as well, though, you know, I have to say my experience is somewhat limited, but these hermetic texts such as Tantra and Kabbalah, such devices, schematics are available. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of a wide subject because it interfaces with, you know, astral travel and oracular, you know, contact with, like, deity sadhana practices are everybody, you know, most people in the spiritual traditions mm-hmm. have heard of it in one form or the other. Mm-hmm. The technological counterpart is, you know, somewhere where science and I think that such possibilities are available and might even be happening. I don't know. Uh-huh. Maybe I discover that others are already doing that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm very...
That's the focus of your podcast, is these different stories.
The focus of the podcast is new paradigms mm-hmm. that are emerging. But yeah, some of my recent podcasts, actually in the description for this event, I had a conversation with a hermetic teacher from the Sufi tradition. He's one of my guides, and unknowingly I was kind of hesitant to not ask him questions from things that interest me, mm-hmm. but it just turned out that the whole conversation was about that.
Very interesting.
And it was not something that I had an intention, but he just took it there, and
wow.
seemed like he had a lot of experience. Actually, Deanna, you listened to that interview. Mm-hmm. And
it's really good.
Yeah, I was just shocked. It just seemed like that was his world, and it was like, oh, little kid, come here. We've been doing this for thousands of years. Welcome. So
I'm curious if there's a interplay between the technology that's available today and this kind of very inner transformational space that, you know,
yes,
as far as becoming or creating stargates.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, thank you for that question. So it's connected, my answer perhaps is connected to both of you. My previous iteration of this talk was more focused on the title was An Alternative History of Technology and Its Future. And what I did was that actually Hermeticism is the preceding tradition to alchemy. And alchemy is, as you know, the word rhymes with chemistry. It's the etymology of chemistry, or origin of chemistry. And but not just chemistry, actually. A lot of our contemporary information technology, including, you could say, AI, has been very directly borrowed from the Hermetic traditions, because science and the subject and the object have been more, at least in our minds, have been separated more now, but traditionally we're not separate in the tradition of Hermetic traditions, right? So I don't think that we have to do much other than to return to that mutual transformation, that contact exercise that we did. If our experiments become that form of contact and that possibility that in fact the cosmos is alive, you know, if we get rid of our hubris, I'm excited. I think there's that's, you know, people like Newton and Leibniz, the father of calculus. His PhD thesis was around building a stargate, something similar, not exactly, but making combinations of glyphs for receiving transcendent information about reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what the Kabbalists have done. That's what the sciences of the mantra is. But it definitely is a demanding endeavor. And, you know, we have heard of rishis, and a lot of these texts in these traditions are revealed texts, which means that they're a very high level of channeling, so to speak. But I feel that we're becoming open to such possibilities again. Yeah.
Thank you, Kenna,
thank you.
Bringing this forth tonight and the opportunity to taste that experience. Do we have any other questions for or observations, comments from the audience?
I was just going to share that I brought a charging cable for an iPhone for the altar, and when I tuned into it, it was quite an organic experience, like an umbilical cord come serpent, and yeah, just part of the mysteriousness I think we're tuning into about these realms of
Pluto and Aquarius.
Yeah.
And Rahu just went into an Aquarius.
My artifact that I like is the sword, and it connects me with the intention of focus, channel into a single strike. Everything you got, put it in there. Or to be struck. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Let me offer a couple.